Your North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It is the Indie Week podcast. I'm John Federson reading this week's issue, dated June 1st of 2022. And our musician today, and as a single musician, is recreating a career back from almost total obscurity. This is the former cartoon great Mr. Gerald Mick Boing Boing. And of course, I can remember him on the Saturday morning cartoons. The power to imitate almost any sound on earth just with vocal prowess alone. And we certainly wish Mr. Mick Boing Boing success, because he's shown that he's not lacking any of his former skills, doing all the violin and piano parts himself. And we gave him a little bit of extra time before we get into our Indie Week for today. Opening from the print issue by Tomasi McDonald, Cut and Run. Daryl Howard's voice was thick with anguish as he talked about the Durham City Council's decision to not pay him $6 million that a federal jury awarded after he spent decades in prison for two murders he did not commit. A jury concluded last December at the end of a nearly months-long civil rights trial that a police detective had manufactured evidence that resulted in Howard spending more than two decades behind bars after he was wrongly convicted for the murders of a 29-year-old woman and her 13-year-old daughter in 1991. Howard says, "All those years sitting in prison, all the things that I have seen that will never leave my mind." Court records show that the victims, Doris Washington and her child, Nishonda, had both been raped before their murders inside their apartment at the former Few Gardens public housing complex. Doris died of blunt force trauma to her abdomen. Nishonda had been strangled. On March 31, 1995, Durham County Superior Court Judge James Spencer sentenced Howard to serve 80 years in prison after he was convicted for the second-degree murders of the Washingtons. He was also convicted of first-degree arson and sentenced to an additional 40 years after prosecutors contended he lit a fire in the apartment before fleeing. On December 1, 2016, after Howard had served more than 23 years behind bars, Durham Senior Resident Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson ordered that his convictions be vacated and that he be released from prison following a DNA analysis that indicated he was innocent. On April 30, 2021, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper issued Howard a pardon of innocence. He received $750,000 in compensation. Howard says about the time he was locked up, "There was a lot of abuse. I worked in segregation, where you see the worst in prison. I used to think, why, God, why did you choose something like me for this?" On December 1, 2021, a jury in the U.S. District Court, Middle District's Durham Division, deliberated for about an hour before determining that former Durham Police Detective Daryl Dowdy had violated Howard's civil rights when he fabricated evidence and demonstrated, quote, a bad faith failure to investigate the double murders. Howard says he learned in April that Durham City Council members went into closed session and decided they weren't going to pay him. He said, "Durham decided 24 years of my life wasn't worthy. It brought tears to my eyes." Criticism of the City Council's decision has been intense, with pleas from residents to get council members to go on record as to why they decided not to pay Howard. The Indy reached out to Durham Mayor Elaine O'Neill and her fellow council members, Leonardo Williams, Jillian Johnson, and Mark Anthony Middleton, who are all Black Americans, along with Javiera Caballero, the first Latinx person elected to City Council. Howard's attorney, who's based in Chapel Hill, is Brad Bannon. He says, "They have all complained in the past about systemic racism, and this decision is completely opposed to that view." The council members, owing to ongoing litigation, referred the Indies question to Durham City Attorney Kimberly Rayburg, who said the City Council's decision was made following a series of closed-door sessions soon after the federal jury's verdict to award between December 2021 and February of this year. Rayburg stated via a series of emails to Indy that the City Council's decision not to pay Howard the $6 million jury award hinged on a single paragraph approved by the City Council four decades ago. The city's two-and-a-half-page resolution establishing uniform standards under which claims or civil judgments sought or entered against city officers and employees may be paid was approved by City Council members on September 8th of 1981. Section 5 of that resolution states, quote, whereas it is in the public interest that claims made or judgments entered against officers or employees of the cities be satisfied by the cities, if the facts and circumstances of the claim or suit in which the judgment is entered show that the officer or employee was engaged in the good faith performance of his duties on behalf of the city when the act or omission giving rise to the claim or suit occurred. A jury of Duty's peers, quote, determined that Mr. Duty engaged in fabrication of evidence and a bad faith failure to investigate, Rayburg explained, and said paying Howard after that city council determined Doughty acted in bad faith is prohibited by state law. Quote, once the jury made those factual findings, the city's hands were tied. Bannon says he thinks the jury council members are, quote, using the jury verdict as an excuse to cut and run, and that, quote, somehow the jury verdict prohibits the city council from moving forward, and that's simply not true. You don't need a resolution to defend Daryl Doughty for 5 years. Howard wonders why the city of Durham won't acknowledge that Doughty's corrupt investigation was under the direction of higher-ups in the police department. Howard says he took orders. He did what they said, so why can't they pay? He did this because the police department told him to. When Doughty arrested me, I heard his superior officer tell him two times that he had done a good job. Barry Scheck, co-founder of the nation's original Innocence Project at Yeshiva University's Cardozo Law School, became a member of Howard's defense team when Howard contacted the Innocence Project nearly 20 years ago. Scheck told Indy that the city council's decision to not pay Howard after the federal jury's verdict was ridiculous. Quote, what's particularly upsetting is the city of Durham took the position to pay out $4 million for Daryl Doughty's defense, and now they won't pay Howard. I wish I knew, he answered when asked why he thought the city declined to pay his client the jury award. Quote, right-thinking people have condemned it. It's very cruel and very upsetting to Daryl. An innocent man, wrongly convicted, makes me think about the other Daryl, Scheck adds, referring to Daryl Hunt, who was 19 in 1984 when he was wrongly convicted and served 19 years behind bars before he was released in 2005. Hunt took his own life in 2016. He was 51. Scheck says, I pray every day Daryl stays sane. I don't know how these people could be so cavalier and cruel. It's perverse. Though city officials have taken a lot of heat for paying $4 million to defend Doughty, Rayburg, the city attorney, said the $4 million in legal fees were not solely for Doughty's defense. She says $1.5 million was spent in legal fees defending the city of Durham. The remaining $2.5 million paid for the defense of Doughty, along with that of three other police officers, Scott Penica, E.E. Sarvis, and Michelle Soucy, and retired fire marshal Milton Smith. Rayburg says prior to the jury verdict, the city of Durham, quote, did engage in good faith efforts to settle the case on behalf of all the named defendants in three separate mediation settlement conferences, and that the city's offers were remarkably close to what the jury ultimately awarded to Mr. Howard at the close of the trial. Bannon scoffs at the city attorney's assertion and says the city offered Howard $4.5 million, less than the jury's award and not accounting for accrued interest and legal fees. Quote, First of all, there were only two mediation sessions, and each time the settlement offer wasn't anything close, let alone remarkably close, to the jury award. There are other troubling unresolved issues about the case. Doris and Nishonda Washington's killers remained at large. Court documents suggest that a man who was a juvenile at the time may have significant information about who was responsible for the mother and child's death. The man's DNA was found in Doris Washington, but he remains free. Howard says he pleaded the fifth in front of the judge. Judge Hudson asked the district attorney if they were going to let the man walk out of the courtroom. He's still walking around free. And Bannon says the Durham Police Department is not interested in investigating because someone was wrongfully convicted. That would admit they got it wrong. Owing to the city's resolution of not indemnifying city employees who act in bad faith, Dowdy, described in a News and Observer story in April as a 30-year police veteran who made nearly $76,000 annually when he retired in 2007, stands to lose everything he owns to pay Howard $6 million. Citing financial hardship on March 4th, Dowdy's attorneys have filed a motion to stay the proceedings to enforce the jury's verdict because the Durham Council should have complied. The motion also indicates Dowdy may file a lawsuit against the city. Bannon says Dowdy's financial situation is not of concern to his client's interest, saying, "The victim here in no shape or form is Daryl Dowdy. We'll take his house, his car, and all his money. But the victim here is Daryl Howard." Meanwhile, Howard spends his days working at a nonprofit he started in 2018, the Daryl Howard Foundation, and taking care of his 2-year-old son, Kai. "I'm never giving up," he says. "I don't have a giving up bone in my body." Another police-related report by Jasmine Gallup from Raleigh. Street justice. 2 years after the murder of George Floyd and citywide protests calling for police reform, there's still no justice for the black and brown people killed and brutalized by Raleigh police officers, activists say. In fact, the state of policing in Raleigh has arguably gotten worse. Kerwin Pittman, a local activist, told the Indy, "Once you create a culture where I can come and beat up on you and there's no ramifications for my actions, guess what we're going to keep doing? More and more people are going to keep beating up on you because there's no ramifications. It's about accountability." Pittman has been hard at work in the 2 years since the Black Lives Matter movement resurged, meeting with people who have had violent encounters with the police, lobbying to get body camera footage released, and pressuring government officials to take stronger steps against officers who act inappropriately. But in some ways, his work has been in vain. In those same 2 years, Raleigh police have shot and killed 5 people, leaving their families awash in a sea of grief and confusion. In January, Daniel Tercios, 43, was shot 5 times in front of his wife and 2 children. Tercios was smeared by police and media following the shooting, described as an intoxicated and a knife-wielding man. But the facts that slowly trickled out in the weeks and months afterwards disproved the initial narrative. The knife that Tercios had was a pocket knife, too small to be seen on a cell phone video taken by a witness. The toxicology report shows Tercios had no drugs or alcohol in his system, merely caffeine and nicotine. Body camera footage reveals Tercios, who didn't speak English and couldn't understand officers' commands, was trying to walk away from police when he was first tasered in the back. Rosa Jerez, Tercios' wife, said at a press conference, "My children were yelling at the police and asking them to not kill him. He was killed like a dog." In the 4 months since Tercios was shot and killed, the state has completed an investigation. Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman will decide whether to press criminal charges against the 2 officers involved. Freeman said in an email, the State Bureau of Investigation provided its investigation tour approximately 30 days ago and wrote, "I asked for some additional information, which we are working on obtaining. A decision has not been made in this case, but I expect will be in the next few weeks." Historically, however, officers who kill men of color are not held accountable even when they're involved in multiple violent incidents. Officer W.B. Tapscott, who tasered Tercios, is also the officer who fatally shot Keith Collins in 2020, firing at him four times as he ran away, and seven more times after he fell to the ground. Collins was carrying a BB gun. Freeman decided not to press charges in Collins' case, saying Tapscott reasonably believed his life was in danger and was justified in using deadly force. But Pittman says that's exactly what needs to change, saying we need to start looking at a more non-lethal way of responding to different incidents. It starts with the department here really saying, let's look at our training manuals, our policies, and let's change in a way that values life, where we don't take it at the first instance that we feel like we have justification in the eyes of the law. When officers don't face consequences for killings, it's no wonder the killings continue, says Pittman. Just last month, Raul Rodriguez Nunez, 37, was killed after police opened fire with more than 30 rounds. The shooting followed a confrontation outside a southeast Raleigh police station where Rodriguez Nunez was throwing a Molotov cocktails at police cars. Pittman says Rodriguez Nunez's case isn't as clear-cut as some others, but his death was avoidable. Of course it was preventable, he says. You have a guy throwing Molotov cocktails, and you have individuals with firearms. They could have easily deployed something else instead of shooting. And he goes on, I've thought about it long and hard. During the George Floyd protests, we were shot with rubber bullets. Why wasn't this man shot with a rubber bullet? Why is the first resort to always kill? Pittman and other activists had hoped the culture of policing in Raleigh would change after a new police chief, Estella Patterson, was appointed in August of last year. Patterson took the place of former chief Cassandra Deck Brown, who retired earlier in 2021, following a barrage of criticism from protesters. Dawn Blagrove, executive director of Emancipate NC, says she hoped Patterson would take a more common-sense approach to officers who have behaved badly and acknowledge their misconduct. So far, she says, she's been disappointed. Quote, while the new chief is taking a much more objective tone than we typically saw from Chief Deck Brown, I think what we are not seeing from this chief is real accountability for her law enforcement officers and for things that they are doing that are excessive. Since the new chief has been in place, we've seen an incredible uptick in police-involved shootings in Raleigh and a really unprecedented amount of hostility and violence. Although Patterson fired Detective Omar Abdullah, who arrested more than a dozen men on trumped-up drug trafficking charges, other officers who raided the home of an innocent family on Abdullah's word are still employed, said Blagrove. Quote, while Abdullah was fired, there was a whole team of officers involved in that nefarious behavior. All of them are still employed with RPD. All of them still actively getting paychecks and are still actively working, and none of them have been held accountable for the abuses of trust that happened and the trauma that was caused. Police Sergeant Brian Scioli, who wrongfully arrested 17-year-old Naina Williams during a Black Lives Matter protest in 2020, remains a member of the Raleigh Police Department, according to a recent report by the News and Observer. This even after the city agreed to pay Williams $37,500 in an out-of-court settlement last month. Scioli is also the officer who was caught on video threatening a teenager in 2016 after the teen wrote F the police in snow on his cruiser. I'll assault you all I want, man, Scioli says, followed by, I'm allowed to threaten people. I'm police. Blagrove says that officer still has a job. Even though it's clear he violated Naya's rights, that he lied about what actually happened, after the investigation, he still has a job. That's problematic. The police department, under the leadership of Patterson, has petitioned the court to release body camera footage in some cases, including those killings of Tercios and Rodriguez Nunez. But for Pittman, that's not enough. He argues the department's commitment to transparency wavers on a case-by-case basis. He says, This is a typical ploy that I've seen from the police department. When they feel that a shooting they do is justifiable in the court of public opinion. In Daniel Tercios' case, they petitioned for the body camera footage to be released because they felt like they could sway people in the court of popular opinion without really laying out clear facts of what happened and what particularly led up to this incident. On that same day in court, Pittman says, the department petitioned against body camera footage being released in an incident where police officers raided the wrong house. Quote, that's the pattern that I'm seeing with them. And if it's transparency, it has to be clear transparency when you're right or when you're wrong. It can't be only when you feel like you're right. The results of internal police investigations are not public record, so the names of officers who have complaints sustained against them, as well as the consequences they may face, are often unknown. Additionally, North Carolina district attorneys are now required to report officers whom prosecutors don't deem credible as witnesses in court to their agencies. Freeman says her office, quote, had approximately 10 to 12 officers over the last seven years who we had deemed not credible. Writing on, fortunately, when this happened historically, their agency terminated them and we dismissed all charges in which they were key witnesses. But again, the officers are shielded by personnel laws, so while the law enforcement agency is notified when an officer is deemed not credible, the public is not informed. Patterson remains committed to transparency, she said in an email to Indy last week. My commitment to transparency remains steadfast, and I will continue to provide updated, timely information as it becomes available. She was referring to Tercios' shooting. Going on, the investigation regarding the officer-involved shooting that occurred on January 11th has not yet been concluded, as we are still waiting on the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation and the Wake County District Attorney to present their findings. But ultimately, anything Patterson does to improve the department, says Blagrove, is going to be deeply undercut by the wayward behavior of her officers. Quote, while I appreciate she does not necessarily have control over the team or culture she inherits, I do believe that it's her responsibility to be very proactive in creating a culture that is more respectful of the role they play and the community they served. Pittman had a blunter criticism of Patterson. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, he says. I think Patterson may have good intentions because she hasn't shown cruel intentions yet, but it's a point of matter getting in there and doing the brunt of the work. Putting policies in place to hold these people accountable and also putting policies in place that creates true transparency. I'll move now to IndyWeek.com, the online version of the publication that I've been reading, because it has a few stories that are more current than the yesterday's, that is to say, June the 1st. This by Lynn Bonner on June the 2nd, originally published at North Carolina Policy Watch, says, Republican-led NC Senate gives preliminary approval to Medicaid expansion after fighting it for years. They gave preliminary approval for coverage to adults who are currently ineligible for the government health insurance. The vote marks a significant milestone for a chamber whose leaders for about a decade fought expanding health coverage by threatening a lawsuit, criticizing expansion in newspaper opinion pages, and passing a law to block it. Democrats in the state have been pushing for Medicaid expansion for years. North Carolina is one of a dozen states that has not expanded. Senator Gladys Robinson, a Guilford County Democrat, said, It does my heart good that even though it took 10 years, you all are there. Praise the Lord. Even with the Senate vote, there's no guarantee that expansion will become law. House Speaker Tim Moore, a Kings Mountain Republican, told reporters last week the House would not consider expansion in this legislative session, which is a short one. Senate Leader Phil Berger, an Eden Republican who was a vocal opponent of expansion, offered a host of reasons for his changed views. As the Senate moved toward its 44-2 vote, Berger told senators, quite frankly, our work has just begun. For this to become law, there are 120 people on the other side of the building we've got to start working on. The 2012 Supreme Court decision in the Affordable Care Act upheld most of the law, but said that expanding Medicaid was optional for states. That left most low-income adults in North Carolina who didn't have dependent children caught in something called the health insurance gap. They make too much money to qualify for Medicaid and too little to qualify for subsidized insurance coverage available through health insurance marketplaces. Parents with children at home must have very low incomes to qualify for Medicaid. About 2.7 North Carolinians are now enrolled in Medicaid. Most are children. The federal government pays more than two-thirds of North Carolina's Medicaid costs. For people who enroll under expanded Medicaid, the federal government covers 90% of the cost. Under the bill, hospitals would pay the other 10%. The bill's author said the bill sets it up so the hospitals will get that money back from the federal government. Additionally, the federal government is offering financial incentives to states that have not expanded Medicaid, which for North Carolina would mean an additional $1.5 billion over 2 years. Berger said Medicaid expansion has evolved to a point that it is good state fiscal policy. We will not get a better deal to expand Medicaid than we have right now. Estimates of how many North Carolinians would be eligible for Medicaid under expansion range from about 200,000 to 600,000. The coalition Care for Carolina, which for years has been trying to get the state to expand, estimates that about 600,000 people are in that coverage gap. Many of those adults work at jobs that don't offer insurance. The coalition said in a statement, the Senate's action today is a major step toward helping hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians who are currently in that gap, including working parents, small businesses across the state, and 14,000 of our veterans. Closing that gap by expanding Medicaid will improve the health of our people, economy, and our entire health care system. Rolled up in the bill are changes to the Certificate of Need law, under which the state determines whether a new medical facility or expensive piece of medical equipment is needed in an area, and a change that allows nurses with advanced degrees to practice independent of doctor's supervision. The legislature has debated both those issues for years. Hospitals oppose changing the Certificate of Need law, and doctors don't want to change the law requiring advanced practice nurses to have doctor's supervisors. Senator Ralph Hayes, a Spruce Pine Republican, says this bill addresses both demand-side and supply-side health care reforms. Senator Mike Woodard, a Durham Democrat, said Medicaid expansion would be good for the economy and rural health care. With insurance, thousands of people who don't now receive preventative care would be able to get it. Yes, it's about cost and access, Woodard says. But in the end, remember, this bill is about better outcomes. That previous article had originally been published online at NC Policy Watch, and so is this one by James Burrow. New bill would exempt sales tax on menstrual products, providing them free in schools. Bill sponsor Representative Julie Von Hafen, Democrat of Wake, says it's a monthly expense that many individuals and families simply cannot afford. Access to these products is a factor that impacts students' well-being, attendance, and performance. A new bill would exempt sales tax on these products and make them free in public schools through a recurring grant program, said Julie Von Hafen, the primary bill sponsor. At a press conference at the General Assembly, students and legislators explained how the measure could help families afford feminine hygiene products, which can be expensive. Von Hafen said, it's a monthly expense that many individuals and families simply cannot afford. Access to menstrual products is a factor that impacts well-being, attendance, and performance. For this reason, we worked hard in a bipartisan effort to ensure that the budget had funding for the Feminine Hygiene Products Grant Program. The funds would be directed to public schools to purchase the products. These products include tampons, panty liners, menstrual cups, sanitary napkins, and other similar products. Grooming and hygiene products, such as cleaning products, soaps, shampoos, toothpaste, etc., are not included in the bill. Van Haffen also mentioned how the rise of inflation is a key factor in the affordability of these products. The products are considered luxury items and subject to a 4.75% sales tax, too. One Cary High School student said the tax has a disproportionate impact on low-income menstruators and can lead to having to choose one essential over another. For low-income students in particular, a lack of access and affordability can make a difference in their education. Currently, states like Virginia, New York, and California have already passed legislation requiring schools to provide free menstrual products for students. More than 20 states have also ended the sales tax on these products. Some include Vermont and Maine. Students and advocates also mentioned the safety measures the bill will give those who need the products. Menstruates have had to resort to using toilet paper and rags to manage feminine hygiene. Such measures can be unsanitary. Some students have also had to go to the school's front office to receive these products or leave early altogether, hindering attendance and learning. The Menstrual Equity for All bill will be the next step of what the Assembly had previously passed for local schools and diaper banks to reduce menstrual poverty and increase equity for families who can't afford feminine hygiene products. The End Menstrual Poverty Act, signed last year by the Senate, let public school units apply for grants of up to $5,000 to purchase feminine hygiene products. Grants were awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. Money ran out in less than a week, according to the Department of Public Instruction, which sent a report to the legislature. The $250,000 appropriation was claimed in less than a week, and fewer than half, the 134 applications, were funded. The legislature made the money available only for the 2021-22 fiscal year. Funding for the grant program in the new bill will be appropriated from the general fund to the Department of Public Instruction, with $500,000 in recurring funds going into next fiscal year. Along with Representative Haven, the bill is sponsored by Allison Dahl, Democrat from Wake, Natalie Murdoch, Democrat of Durham, Natasha Marcus, Democrat of Mecklenburg. Senator Kathy Harrington, Republican of Gaston, helped appropriate funding for the bill, with Senator Julie Mayfield, Democrat of Buncombe, assisting with last year's funding. Brian Rosenzweig from IndieWeek.com, our next article from the print version of IndieWeek, is titled Finding Home Base. It's the cover story. When Kelsey Renee first joined Eno River Rugby, ERR, in 2018, they commuted from Greensboro to Durham, a 45-minute drive on a good day from practices. Friends were confused why Renee gave so much time to a sports team so far away, but ERR was different. Renee says, "With Eno River Rugby, for the first time, I just got to be Kelsey Renee." That's spelled R-E-N-E. "That was a beautiful thing. ERR, the oldest women's rugby club in the state, prides itself on being openly queer and inclusive. As a proud black lesbian, those values are important to Renee." Renee had long been involved in sports. During their undergraduate years, they played women's soccer for Loyola University. But even as they felt accepted, they still bore the weight of being one of the few out queer players, much less one of the few queer people of color on the team. "When I stepped onto that field, I felt othered," Renee said. "With ERR, you go out there on the field for 80 minutes and just play, and that's all that matters." That's stuck with Renee. For 4 years later, they're now the president of the club, a space they once never imagined holding as a queer person of color. But that's what Renee says makes ERR truly unique, saying, People talk about teams being a family, and I've been on every type of team from so young to now. I've never felt the idea of family until I joined Eno River. Sports have long occupied a complicated space for LGBTQ people. In women's sports, stereotypes about queerness and masculinity abound. For trans athletes, there is intense scrutiny of their every move, and terms such as fairness and biological advantage are levied against them. Sports can be a hostile place across all ages and leagues, according to the Trevor Project. Less than one-third of LGBTQ youth participate in sports, with many saying they don't participate out of fear. In 2015, the international study Out on the Fields found that 80% of gay and straight athletes said they had witnessed some form of homophobia in sports. LGBTQ folks who do hold a notable space in sports, like University of Pennsylvania diver Leah Thomas or U.S. women's soccer captain Megan Rapinoe, are often subject to relentless criticism. Since Thomas's win for the 500-yard freestyle in the Division I National Championship in March, she's faced an onslaught of public and media criticism, from personal attacks by right-wing pundits to reactionary anti-trans legislation citing Thomas's win that seeks to ban trans participants from playing in teams corresponding with their gender. The nonprofit Freedom for All Americans reports that 64 anti-trans sports bills are currently active across 29 state legislatures, including the North Carolina Save Women's Sports Act, which has been stalled in the House since last spring. According to the Human Rights Campaign, 2022 is, quote, the worst year on record for anti-LGBTQ legislation across the country. As politicians and members of the public try to draw lines in the sand of who sports are for, the importance of LGBTQ-affirming teams and leagues is more important than ever. 2 years ago, Marty Rogers' friend Garrett Holt asked them to join his new baseball team, the Carolina Crawfish. At first, Rogers demurred. "I was like, Garrett, I'm fat," Rogers says. He said, "Who cares? Come play baseball." Then I was like, "Okay, but I don't run." And he was like, "I don't run either. You run like 10 feet at a time, tops in baseball." So I said, "Fine, I'll come out and play." I've been in love with it since. Carolina Crawfish is not your average baseball team. It's part of the Doc Ellis League, a self-described punk rock baseball league named after the late Pittsburgh Pirates pitcher who famously pitched a no-hitter on LSD. Its model, in other words, goes against the grain. With the spirit of inclusivity, queerness, and communal structure, as upheld by the central rule, no umpires, no managers. Prior to Carolina Crawfish, Rogers' primary experience with sports was a traumatic experience with softball growing up. They had long counted themselves out, but the Crawfish do things differently. "We always like to joke that we are effing suck, but at the same time, we don't suck because we're all just here having fun and trying to improve," says Rogers. Continuing, they're saying their time with Crawfish has been critical in dismantling their internalized belief that sports are solely for able-bodied, athletically elite, and predominantly straight and cisgender athletes. Rogers says, "I think it's extremely important that we're visible and that we're loud about how we're having a good time and taking up space in sports. I think our team is the least white and the least skinny and the least male out of any of the teams in the league." That the Crawfish have also made Rogers aware of how many traditional sports can be a toxic space, even for cisgender males. Quote, "They'll bring their stories of, yeah, I'm a straight dude, but I didn't feel the mold enough. I was too nerdy or skinny or weird. We all share this narrative about not being welcome. So we're kind of like the island of misfit toys." Island Marie and Asher Weyrauch don't have much in common. There's their hair, for starters. Marie's is a rich blue in a traditional crew cut, while Weyrauch's is a soft cherry red swooping across his face, and they're also several grades apart, attend different schools, and differ widely in personal interests. Yet, when they both came to Raleigh Junior Rollers, that's RJR, a gender-inclusive roller derby league in Raleigh that's expressly queer-affirming, one question let them both know they were in the right place. Welcome. What are your pronouns? For the two boys and their parents, who had felt uncomfortable on certain teams, in locker rooms, and in fields over the years, that question was like a sigh of relief. Roller derby, a roller skating contact sport with long-time ties to the LGBTQ community, has provided a space for Marie and Weyrauch to express themselves and build confidence in an affirming league. In skating with people from across the triangle of all gender expressions and backgrounds, and learning to be rough and assertive, while also respectful and kind, the two say they've both grown tremendously. Marie says he loves the theatricality of derby, while on the rink he and others don a ring name like in wrestling. Marie says it's been a really nice means for a lot of people questioning their gender and not yet comfortable transitioning, just being like, well, you can call me this. It offers up a lot of space to learn about performing as a person and how that's not exactly a linear thing, but it's definitely something to be optimistic about and search for improvement within. Weyrauch, who's currently in seventh grade, says, while RJR serves a wide age range, 8 to 17, he thinks it's most impactful for the younger participants, saying, it's really cool, but I think I see a big difference in the children that play, more than the teenagers. Charity Weyrauch, Asher's mom, says RJR has been an important part of Asher's growth in confidence, especially since coming out during the pandemic. Quote, this was really the first thing after he came out where he could see people like him in person, and it's just been amazing to see how happy he was from that. Marie says one of his favorite things about derby is that while it encourages physical development and competition like other sports, it's also based on a foundation of respect and understanding, saying, even though you could frame what we're doing as violent by hitting each other, we're also very respectful of the fact that inside a body is a person and they have feelings. Rugby was the first space where Ash Davison saw queer people like themselves, saying, I grew up in Waxhaw, which is a pretty conservative area, and didn't really understand or know my sexuality at the time. When I joined my rugby team at NC State University, I had finally been in a space that was predominantly queer. Yet, as Davison graduated, they worried that the queer space they'd known, grown used to in college, would cease to exist. Then, they found Eno River Rugby. Quote, when I joined Eno, I realized they're not just in college, they're not just having fun. They're, like those identities, they're real. It was really cool to see that out in the world and see these people continue to take up space. At ER, our teammates often repeat the mantra, everybody is a rugby body. That affirmation that rugby belongs to everyone and beyond the college time frame means a lot to Davison. Quote, it's just that level of comfort and protection in that you know you're with people like yourself and no one's going to question it. Davison believes that Eno River Rugby is a closer community than most teams and thinks that's largely because how meaningful it is for queer and diverse groups to have communities like the club. Quote, our teammates there are not just our teammates, they're also our friends. We do a really good job of welcoming people and being a friendly queer space for people in the area. While many on queer and gender-affirming teams are grateful for the spaces they provide and the progress that's been made, they hope over time to become less of an outlier. Cass, another member of the Crawfish, says while he loves how homemade the team is, he wishes they had more support from the local community, saying, "We don't get much turnout at our games, aside from family and friends of the actual players, but we really do have a good time. A lot of these leagues are often overlooked still, because they're not the professional leagues, or they're not comprised of people you expect to see playing these sports." Renee from ERR says they hope for more visibility in all sports, not just smaller, expressly affirming teams. Quote, "I think there's value in having a predominantly queer space for people to enter, but that does not mean that sport at a high level should be prohibitive to how you identify. You should be able to play in whatever league you feel represents you best." Now, I'm going to take time, although it's well in advance, to talk about the Eno River Festival and their summer lineup, and mention other festivals in the Indie Week online. That festival, Eno River, which takes place every year along the banks of the Eno in North Durham and has now for 43 years, is the kind of event you could risk for taking for granted. But the pandemic has snapped gratitude for live events back into place, and this festival, which sprawls outdoors at West Point for the Eno, is particularly suited for the times. Bring a blanket and a bottle of water, and you're pretty much set for the day. This year, the festival will take place on Saturday, July 2nd, and Monday, July 4th, and will feature 65 artists across four stages. Tickets are available online. And I think there is admission, I don't think there's money admission, but I guess you need a ticket, probably for parking at least. And online, you'll have to look for Eno River Festival. Highlights include H.C. McIntyre, the Branchettes, and Molly Sarley. You can read indie profiles of all these acts online, as well as performances by Daughter of Swords, the African American Dance Ensemble, Tumbao, John Shane and F.J. Ventre, Black House, the Pie-Faced Girls, Willie Carlisle, the Gospel Tones, the Gospel Jubilators, Mellow Swells, Javier Montana's Grupo Noteno, Libby Rodenbaugh, Al Riggs, Joe Newberry, Dissimilar South, Apple Chill Cloggers, Trey Wellington, the Cane Creek Cloggers, Weirs, XOXOK, Secret Monkey Weekend, Sonny Miles, and more. The director of the festival, Greg Bell, says we're excited to return to the full festival experience on the banks of the Eno this year. We enjoyed the virtual events over the past 2 years, but we can't wait to get everyone back together on the Eno to enjoy the exceptional places the festival funding projects. Proceeds go to the nonprofit Eno River Association, which works to conserve the river and resources. Over the past year, the fate of parts of the river and its surrounding property has come into question during a proposed development by West Point that has caused considerable community pushback. If you can't make this particular musical throwdown, others are on the horizon, including a newcomer festival, That Music Fest, which is presented by Come Here, H-E-A-R, Come Here, N-C, and slated for June the 24th and 5th at the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. That Music Fest, I'm sure, has its own website. Its impressive lineup of 25 local acts includes Steep Canyon Rangers, the Mountain Goats, American Aquarium, Mipso, and Reese Palmer, and other summer music series in the Triangle include Carborough's Freight Train Blues Series, Raleigh Summer Concert Series at Pullen Park, and Durham's Rock the Park Movie and Music Series. All of those festivals that I've mentioned have websites. And I'll continue with the print version of music column now by Madeline Crone, Hop on the Bandwagon. It was 98 degrees in downtown Durham on the day Sarah and Austin McCombie performed at the funeral of a man they had never met. What led them here is a testament to that duo, broadly known as Chatham Rabbits, and their abiding efforts to connect through music. What most would call a stranger, Sarah and Austin, consider a friend I've never met. The success of this married couple's musical pursuits hinges on this kindredship. Looking around the gathering, they found only one familiar face, Miss Becky, the grieving wife whom they had just met a few weeks before at a pandemic-friendly performance in her neighborhood. It was one of several stops on Chatham Rabbit's stay-at-home tour that brought live music from a safe distance to the Triangle and beyond, a creative solution to a dismal situation. Miss Becky, in turn, had never heard of Chatham Rabbits before the pair pulled up her street on a trailer turned stage, hitched behind their Sprinter van they could no longer use to tour their sophomore album, The Yoke is Easy, The Burden is Full, which was released in May of 2020. So the McCombies were surprised when she emailed them a few weeks later to request they perform at the funeral of her husband, Henry Wood. Austin says, in normal times, we wouldn't have had the time to do something like this, and we were really honored to do it. In the planning process, Miss Becky described her vision for the service as beautiful, southern, and all about Jesus, and that it was. It was like something out of a movie, continues Austin. Despite the blistering heat, attendees gathered around the American flag draped casket and honored Wood and his hard-fought battle with lung cancer. Beneath the ancient oaks of the historic Duke Cemetery, the duo leaned into their bluegrass roots, paying their respects with a traditional take on the hymn, I'll Fly Away. Austin says, by the end of the service, we were both super emotional. We felt like we knew this man. It made us think what it would be like to be flies on the wall at our own funerals. If we heard what people had to say about us, maybe we would focus less on the little things that bog us down and more on what Sarah says are those eulogy moments, who we are as people. The essence of who someone is can be described so quickly. Their song, Flies at Our Funeral, is the product of a friendship that formed in the face of suboptimal circumstances. Drawing on intimate moments like these, Chatham Rabbits crafted their third album, If You See Me Riding By. Now that's due out June the 3rd. It's tomorrow. The record is a bold step forward for the Americana duo, who, in 2018, opted out of their more conventional roles as teacher and financial advisor to produce the path less followed as full-time musicians. Threaded through all three of their albums is a recurring theme of friendship found along the way. The song, You Never Told Me I Was Pretty, is told through the endearing lens of a fan's 5-year-old granddaughter, Eleanor. This track, their first song added to Spotify curated playlists, Indie Bluegrass and Grassroots, was commissioned as a gift for the fan's husband to honor his relationship with their grandchild. Austin says, she says that he never tells Eleanor that she's pretty or cute or anything about her physical appearance, but he focuses on how she can do anything she sets her mind to. At its core, If You See Me Riding By is a pandemic album. Not in the sense of slapping a label onto a COVID-19 project, but because the album blossomed from the depths of uncertainty, with an emphasis on how people live and connect in isolation. Austin says it's a compilation of experiences we had during a time we could pick our heads up and look around and connect with people we hadn't had time to because we were all in this predicament together. If You See Me Riding By transports the two back to what they jokingly referred to as the honeymoon phase of the pandemic. Until then, the song was just a melody and the first two verses. Sarah says it's centered around the notion of not taking whoever you close with for granted and learning to be a person who can be more humble in this situation. The title track is what they consider a true co-write, a deviation from their previous process. The 2020 album is an artistic union of two sets of separately penned songs. But their new practice is even more personal, revealing their individual personalities more so than writing on their own. This tag-team approach is reflective of their day-to-day life as a married couple. Austin is a self-admitted high-level idea guy, and Sarah brings the concepts back down to earth. She says, Austin's ability to look at the big picture is awesome, but then he gets super overwhelmed by tedious details, and I'm the opposite. I love a to-do list, then get freaked out by high-level plans. That definitely falls into our songwriting. It's apparent all over the album. The song Kill the Snake considers the cost of wishing time away with a retrospective romanticization of aspects of pandemic life. Like many, it took shape with an Austin melody, and again, Sarah swept in to tie loose ends with tangible lyrics that bring the message to life, like eating supper on the floor, our height marks on the door. Chatham Rabbit's musical approach honors old-time music through modern interpretation. Maintaining elements of age-old instrumentation without rigid sonic boundaries expands their audience, further sanctifying the tradition. To build out the album's expansive sound, the pair turned to the producer Saman Kujinian, a friend and previous collaborator. Together, they worked to relinquish the tight grips of what could have defined their artistry. Austin describes Kujinian as a scientist and total standout, adding, "We came to him saying, we want your fingerprints all over this album." And Sarah says, "I really feel proud of my effort to surrender to what we wanted to make with this record and not feel beholden to ways that people think we should sound. I love that imagery of just letting go and creating the art we wanted to and letting the mess of the pandemic sort itself out on the record." And again, this record to be released is If You See Me Riding By. And it looks as if the party or the ceremony for tour release is going to be at the Hall River Ballroom in Saxapahaw tomorrow, which is June 3rd at 8 p.m., with an admission of $28. Chatham Rabbits, the name of the duo. And once again, thanks to Mr. Gerald McBoingboing, today's musical guest performing our theme song, and that theme song for Indie Week and IndieWeek.com. And John Federson was reading this broadcast, which goes into our podcast section of ncreadingservice.org. We're certainly happy and hope that you enjoyed this issue of Indie Week, and we put out a new issue every week and hoping you'll join us again. So, for the North Carolina Reading Service, goodbye, folks.